Today is Monday, January 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, prayers were chanted over the remains of a top Iranian general killed in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad. It's an attack that has drastically raised tensions between Tehran and Washington. We'll have those stories and more next. The leader of the Palestinian militant group Hamas is in Tehran attending the funeral of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani, who was killed in a U.S. airstrike in Iraq. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley starts us off.
Ismail Haniyeh, in an address to Iranian mourners, described the slain General Qassem Soleimani as a martyr of Jerusalem. Haniyeh vowed that Palestinian militant groups, including his Islamic group that controls Gaza, will walk Soleimani's way to confront the Zionist project and the American influence. Haniyeh's visit to Iran was surprising. In December, Egypt allowed him to travel for his first regional tour since 2017 election into the Hamas leadership on the condition that he wouldn't visit Iran, according to Arab and Israel media reports. I'm Zaria Shakli.
Now, in response to the slaying, Tehran announced it was abandoning the remaining limits of its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. The developments could bring Iran closer to building an atomic bomb, set off a proxy or military attack launched by Tehran against America, and enable the Islamic State group to stage a comeback in Iraq, making the Middle East a far more dangerous and unstable place. For more, Stratfor senior military strategist Omar Lamrani joins us. Omar, thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I was wondering if you could really quickly break down what the implications of Soleimani's death may have on the region.
Well, I think the two biggest implications, the first one is domestically in Iraq. This has galvanized the Iraqi parliament to push for the United States to exit, under pressure from the Iranian factions in there, but also from some nationalists like Sadr, who saw the assassination as having been a step too far in terms of flaunting Iraqi's sovereignty. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect, even potentially more dangerous, even more significant, is that Iran is preparing to launch a military counterstrike that could lead to a cycle of violence and potentially even war. They are very serious about it. They've been preparing their domestic audience for it, the international audience for it. They saw the assassination as having crossed the red line, and they see it as forcing their hand to reestablish some deterrence with the United States.
Speaking of domestic audiences that the Iranian government has been speaking to, Iran has had several different protests going on for a long amount of time, and we look at the streets being filled by those mourning Soleimani's death. Has this, in some analyst circles, they're saying that the attack backfired. Has this united the people of Iran?
Well, that's certainly something that the government is trying to take advantage of, in the sense of reminding the people of the external enemy, and the way the assassination happened as well. It's definitely something that could push the Iranian government to consolidate a little bit more control and divert attention from domestic issues more towards the United States as the culprits. In fact, for a long time, hardliners in Iran, looking at the domestic problems that they have had internally, have argued that perhaps they should pursue a more aggressive line with the United States to divert attention more towards the external adversary rather than focus on the internal problems.
Iran has said it's walking away completely from the 2015 nuclear deal. Is there any chance, any hope of salvaging that kind of last remnants of hope that the European signatories could get something done?
It seems very remote at this stage. The Iranians are asking for basically the sanctions removal, and they're going back to the JCPOA as originally formulated. It's doubtful with this administration, at least, that's something that would be considered. If we go through a cycle of violence and emerge from that, potentially there could be negotiations to calm down the situation. Potentially, new administration could come in that could pursue a somewhat more lenient line on Tehran. But for now, as it is, it's doubtful that the negotiation, that the JCPOA will be salvaged.
Omar Lamrani is a senior military strategist with Stratfor. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
In the United States, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said that the House will introduce and vote on a war powers resolution this week to limit U.S. President Donald Trump's military actions regarding Iran. Joining us now on the phone is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson for that part of the story. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I think for our international listeners, we often hear the president referred to as the commander-in-chief. So can you briefly explain why Congress is kind of taking this up?
Well, that's right. The U.S. Constitution really divided up responsibilities when it comes to declaring war. The U.S. Congress actually is the body that has the ability to officially declare war here in the United States. Well, it gives the president the responsibilities of the commander-in-chief to direct the armed forces. So it was very deliberately split up so that there wouldn't be any unconsidered unilateral rush to war. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been a lot of conflict between the Congress and the president over who has those responsibilities.
Now, if we take a look to this specific instance, the White House is saying that it already had previous authorization to carry out the attack that killed General Soleimani. But why is Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, saying that they need to have more discussions?
Well, she's really following up on a push by previous U.S. Congresses to assert the ability to declare war and to also authorize funding for any conflicts abroad. Congress wants to have that role in considering a strategy, in deciding what happens with those troops abroad. And Nancy Pelosi here is saying President Donald Trump hasn't adequately consulted the legislative body, and then he needs to do that. This resolution will hem him in when it comes to that decision making.
We have about 30 seconds left. This is really the first week that Congress is back after the winter recess. What is on their plate in addition to this?
Well, of course, we still have the issue of impeachment. The U.S. House voted on that just before they left for the winter break. Now we're coming back to that continuing conflict between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell over how to transmit those articles of impeachment and how a Senate impeachment trial should run in terms of witnesses and revelation of documents. They are still at odds over that issue as we open the new session of Congress.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you very much for your time today.
You're so welcome.
Kenyan police say they have arrested three men who tried to force their way into a British Army training camp on the same day that Al-Shabaab extremists attacked a military base and killed three U.S. military personnel. The internal police report, as seen by the Associated Press, says the three terrorist suspects were arrested Sunday after they were trying to enter the British Army training unit at Laikipia County. It occurred around the same time as the Al-Shabaab assault on the base in Lamu County. The British government has not immediately been available for comment. The U.S. Africa Command also told the AP on Monday that five U.S. aircraft were destroyed and one damaged in al-Shabaab's hours-long assault at the Manda Bay airfield. It was the al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab's first attack against U.S. forces inside Kenya, where the extremists have carried out multiple deadly attacks against civilian targets, including buses, schools, and shopping malls. Joining us now with more is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve.
So what can you tell us about what's taking place on the ground in Kenya this hour?
Well, what I can tell you as of this hour is everybody is responding to what happened yesterday. I know that there has been a response force, an East African response force, dispatched to Kenya from Djibouti. That is where the United States has its only base. About 3,000 to 4,000 American troops are in that base in Djibouti. And this response force is going to Kenya to help further secure the base that was attacked, where three Americans were killed. One of those was a U.S. soldier. The other two are contractors. There were two Americans that were also wounded during this attack yesterday. They're in stable condition and they have been evacuated. But right now, I think there's a lot of assessing going on, because what I've been learning from officials is this was just about 20 al-Shabaab, fewer than 20 al-Shabaab fighters started this attack with RPGs, indirect fire, and were able to breach the security gate, go through the perimeter and then make it to the airfield and kill Americans. So I think the fallout will be, how was this possible in Kenya?
Speaking of how is this possible, as I said, this is really the first attack against a U.S. base, and there was another attack against
this
the
is
British.
A Kenyan base, but Americans are there.
Right,
yes.
Right. Yes. A Kenyan base, but Americans were there. Are Pentagon officials concerned about the change in al-Shabaab's tactics?
Well, it is clear that al-Shabaab has felt emboldened recently. We saw the potential attack against the base housing the Brits. We saw the attack on the United States. But I was talking to one official who had an interesting perspective on it. He said that he felt this was done to distract from what had happened in late December when al-Shabaab had carried out an attack that killed about 80 innocent people in Mogadishu. They got a lot of bad press on that, so to speak, a bad reaction from civilians, from the population on that. And I think the way that this official described it to me, he said that he felt that this is al-Shabaab's way of trying to remain relevant and trying to shift the narrative to say that they're still a bad fighting force for the people, even though they're killing scores of innocent people.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
The Iraqi parliament approved the resolution calling for the country's caretaker government to end the bilateral agreement with U.S.-led coalition to station troops on Iraqi soil. An Iraqi parliament speaker indicated that the agreement with the coalition cannot be terminated without a one-year grace period. Edward Uranian reports on the fallout from a U.S. strike that Iran killed a military commander there.
Several dozen mostly Shiite members of the Iraqi parliament chanted against the U.S. and in favor of Iran and its slain military commander Qasem Soleimani before ultimately voting to authorize the government to arrange for an end to the agreement with the U.S.-led coalition to station troops in the country. Caretaker Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi addressed legislators before the non-binding vote Sunday, urging them to act in the face of what he called breaches of the agreement by the coalition in attacking a militia base in Qaim, which killed 25 Shiite militiamen, and the drone strike, which killed Soleimani and Shiite militia commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. He says he calls on MPs to study carefully any decision on what to do about the breach of Iraq's sovereignty and security and make sure the decision doesn't damage Iraq's national interests or security. 173 members of the Iraqi parliament out of 329 attended the extraordinary session, which approved the five-point plan authorizing the government to terminate the agreement with the U.S.-led coalition. The coalition has officially suspended its training of Iraqi military forces, but is still protecting bases where it is present. Iraqi Parliament Speaker Mohammed al-Halbousi noted that the agreement cannot be terminated without a grace period. He says that the agreement between the U.S. and Iraq stipulates that any decision to end the coalition's mission in the country cannot take effect until the end of a one-year grace period. It was also not clear if Iraq's caretaker Prime Minister Abdel Mahdi has the authority to call for the end of Iraq's agreement with the coalition. Iraqi analyst Ziad Al-Arar told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that members of the Iraqi parliament are grandstanding in order to appease their constituents, but a new government with solid political backing needs to be in place before any decision can be made to end the agreement with the coalition. Political analyst Kamran Bukhari told VOA that the post-Saddam Hussein Iraqi state has been balancing between the U.S. and Iran since its inception. He argues that the pendulum is now swinging towards the Iranians, but not fully. While it is difficult to completely assess what is going on, Bukhari notes that many analysts are treating this as a disruptive moment. Lebanon's pro-Iranian Hezbollah leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, delivered a fiery speech to his supporters in Beirut, urging the Iraqi parliament to expel the U.S. from their country and insisted that the crime of killing Qasem Soleimani must be avenged. Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammed Ali Hakim also sent a complaint to the President of the UN Security Council and the UN Secretary General to protest the U.S. attack on a Shiite military base near Iraq's border with Syria and the killing of Soleimani and Shiite militia commander Mohandas. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened to demand billions of dollars in compensation from Iraq or impose sanctions like they've never seen before if it does go through with expelling U.S. troops. U.S. Ambassador John Bass left Kabul on Monday as his two-year tenure as America's top diplomat in the war-torn country has ended. Until Bass's replacement is decided, Washington is appointing a charge d'affaires to the post, according to a statement from the U.S. State Department. Ross Wilson, who has served as America's ambassador to Turkey and Azerbaijan, is expected in the Afghan capital in the coming weeks. The on-again and off-again talks between the United States and the Taliban have appeared again to have stalled. The negotiations are a key pillar in Washington's goal of reaching a political settlement with Afghanistan. The latest hiccup in the talks appears to be the issue of what a ceasefire or a reduction in the violence may look like if the insurgents agree to a truce. And you're listening to VOA News.
The 62nd Annual Grammy Awards Show is coming up. To celebrate, Border Crossings will play songs from the winners of the 2019 American Music Awards to refresh you on some of last year's best tracks. Tune in to hear from your favorite artists like Post Malone, BTS, and Taylor Swift, January 23rd on The Voice of America.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Mali's armed forces say that five soldiers were killed near the nation's border with Mauritania when their own convoy was bombed. The Malian forces were killed in the attack by extremists on Monday in Altonia, according to a statement. Four vehicles were also destroyed in the blast. Islamic extremists took over Mali's north in 2012. A rare second day of light rain in Australia is slightly easing efforts to combat the raging brush fires as officials step up evacuation. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
Australia's raging bushfires were eased slightly by a rare second day of light rain on Monday after weeks of a relentless inferno across Australia. But there's been no rest as officials seize the moment to step up evacuations. Some roads that were once blocked along the coast of New South Wales were reopened, helping people stranded for days to escape.
I've got my family, my cousins, my daughter, my dogs. I think with everybody going on the road, it's just a bit eerie.
After receiving flak for being slow to act, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced a further $2 billion Australian to help rebuild.
The Commonwealth is committing an initial $2 billion over the next two calendar years, starting right now, to support all of the efforts of recovery right across the country. This is not just in those areas that are experiencing fires now. They are in those areas that have already experienced fires, particularly up in Queensland and northern New South Wales.
A new estimate on Monday put damage from the fires since November at an estimated $260 million. In New South Wales southeast, one of the worst hit areas, businesses ranging from dairy and cheesemakers to holiday rental homes are reporting hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses. And in Victoria, fires have killed large numbers of livestock, gutting a $3.3 billion Australian dollar industry.
And that figure equates to about $2.3 billion US dollars. Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. The United Nations Children's Fund is appealing to the warring parties in Syria to protect hundreds of thousands of children at risk of death and displacement from the carnage in and around the northwest province of Idlib. Lisa Schlein has that story.
New Year's Day is traditionally a day of hope, a day when people look forward to a brighter year ahead. On this New Year's Day, UNICEF reports five children aged between 6 and 13 were killed when their primary school in Idlib province was hit by rocket fire. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado acknowledges Syria's warring parties are not likely to respond to her agency's appeal for the fighting to stop, but she says they should.
The children in Syria who have absolutely nothing to do with this conflict are bearing the brunt of this conflict. A whole generation of children have known nothing now but war. How can that be a good thing for anybody?
Some 3 million civilians who live in Idlib province have nowhere to go. They are trapped. All avenues of escape from the fighting are blocked. The United Nations reports more than 235,000 people have been displaced within the region. This since Syrian forces and their Russian allies launched a military offensive to retake Idlib from Al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadists and rebel allies in mid-December. Children account for more than half of those forced to flee their homes. Many have already been displaced multiple times. Children's lives have been disrupted in many other ways as well. Over the past year, UNICEF reports 145 schools in Syria have been attacked, depriving tens of thousands of children of an education. The UN has verified 82 attacks on hospitals and medical staff, depriving children and adults alike of essential health care. Mercado says more than 90% of these attacks were in the northwest, including in Idlib. She tells VOA, young people in Syria are being robbed of their childhood and their dreams.
Some of the testimony that I've heard from mothers is what, you know, is it really hits home when they talk about the change that they see in their children, the lack of hope that their children express, and even the anger at being forced to live through such conditions. These are no conditions for children.
Mercado says UNICEF is on the ground in Syria doing what it can to keep children alive amid the violence, chaos, and biting winter cold. She says UNICEF and partner agencies are providing winter clothes and blankets, clean drinking water, health care, education, and psychological support. While these actions are saving lives, she says they are not enough. Only an end to war and peace, she says, will bring children the safety and prospect of a hopeful future they need and deserve. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The new head of China's liaison office in Hong Kong said he hoped the Asian financial hub, roiled by more than 6 months of anti-government protests, would return to the right path. Luo Huining's appointment is seen as a sign of Beijing's frustration with how his predecessor, Wang Zhimin, handled the crisis and makes Wang the shortest-serving liaison office director since the city's 1997 return to Chinese rule. The liaison office, which reports to China's State Council or Cabinet, is a platform for Beijing to project its influence into the city. Unlike Wang, who has worked at China's state news agency and within the liaison office before taking its helm, Luo has no prior experience in Hong Kong. A loyalist of President Xi Jinping, Luo is known for enforcing Communist Party discipline. His appointment comes less than a month after he was given a different job in the Financial and Economic Affairs Committee of the National Legislature. And that's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, and engineer, John Dryden, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. You can also visit our website for in-depth coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day. You can also find archived copies of the show on the program page under the live radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.